If you think about your company as a bag with a bunch of marbles in it, and the marbles are the assets, buyers like to come in and pick out the marbles they want. That's an asset deal. I want this marble, and this marble, and those are, that's what I want. That's an asset deal. You keep the corporate entity and all the other marbles I don't want. Whereas a stock deal, equity deal, says, I'll just buy the bag and all the marbles in it, right? Good, bad, and ugly. Well, as a general rule, buyers prefer asset deals and sellers prefer stock deals because it's just gets rid of it. Buyers don't want the ugly marbles, the litigation, the potential liabilities, you know this stuff. So just for your audience though, typically we find that the buyer wins because they're the ones with the money.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Mark, I understand you had a great conversation with Andy Jones from privateequityinfo.com.
Yeah, private equity is one of these things that, buyers and clients that we talk to and even, sellers and clients that we talk to and buyers as well often ask us about, is private equity buying online businesses? Are they buying Amazon businesses? Are they buying SaaS businesses? And where do they start buying? When do they, what are the lines for it? How does it work? Andy Jones is somebody that I've known now for probably 7-8 years. He's always been very kind by complimenting me on the content we put out. So anyone that compliments me is immediately somebody I like. So we talked about having him on the podcast.
Hold on just a second. You're awesome, Mark. You're a really good guy. And I'm proud to be your partner.
I thought you were stopping the podcast here.
No, I was just complimenting you. That's all. I wanted to be liked by you today.
So okay. Right, well, all right, continue. Thank you, Joe. We will talk about increasing your equity stake in Quiet Light Brokerage after this call.
Awesome.
It's that easy, guys. It's really that easy. So Andy has privateequityinfo.com. It's a fantastic database of private equity activity across the spectrum. So anything from manufacturing to the online world. But something that they do at privateequityinfo.com is they take a look at the trends and what is going on in the world of private equity. And these can be leading economic indicators. And he gave me one trend in particular, and I'm going to let him get into details of it, but it's the holding period for private equity. Because private equity, what they typically do, for anyone that may not know, they're going to make a lot of investments with the goal of growing these businesses, but then exiting these businesses as well, at least a portion of these businesses that they're building up. And the holding period, how long they hold them, can really tell us a lot about the direction of the economy. And what to anticipate next. And so they look at this holding period, the average number of years that private equity is hanging onto a business before they exit it. Right after the recession, that holding period went up to like a number of, I think it was like 8 or 9, because they bought at the peak, then they had to wait for the economy to recover before they could exit. So I'm going to tease here and just say, listen to the podcast to see what the average holding period is right now, what number we want to look out for, to be able to understand, okay, maybe the economy is going to start to retract a little bit and use that for the decisions you want to make.
Wow, this is going to be fascinating. I think we're going to learn about the future of the economy here as well. Hey, before we move to the podcast, I just want to give a shout out to Mike Nunez from Affiliate Manager. Mike, you're probably out riding your bike right now listening to this podcast. Appreciate all the positive feedback you've given us over the last few months. Thank you very much. Let's go to the podcast with Andy Jones.
Great. Andy, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start off with a little bit of background on yourself and where you come from. I'll let you do that part.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So my name is Andy Jones. I'm the founder and owner of Private Equity Info. We're an Austin, Texas-based company. We own several websites, but our flagship website is really privateequityinfo.com. And this is where we provide an M&A research database that helps investment bankers and private equity firms and even the corporates close more deals. So I have an engineering background and an investment banking background. That's kind of what led me onto this journey of entrepreneurship 14 years ago.
Yeah, pretty cool. And you're one of the people, I will confess, you feed my ego whenever we send out messages by saying, really great content, Mark. And I'm like, hey, I like this Andy guy.
Good
stuff. I like that. Well, cool. Well, we're going to talk about private equity today because you do have privateequityinfo.com and really good information through that site. How long have you had that now?
So yeah, we launched 14 years ago, January of 05. So this is year 14.
Goodness, you know, I remember when everybody's sites was like 3-4 years old, and somebody who had like an 8-year-old site, it was like ancient. And now
I know. Now I'm that guy.
So now you're that guy, right? I own a 20-plus-year-old site, and then Quiet Light Brokerage. This is going to be our 11th anniversary coming up next month. Actually, by the time this episode airs, we'll have surpassed 11 years. So really, really cool. So again, private equity is what we're going to talk about today. We get this question all the time from buyers, right? People want to know things like who's buying online businesses, and would private equity be interested? At what levels are private equity interested? Mm-hmm. And how do those deals sort of differ from other deals? You have your pulse in the industry more so than anybody else that I know. So I thought, hey, let's talk about this. I think this would be a really
Sounds good
sort of thing to go into. So let's talk about just kind of the typical private equity deals, you know, and from what you are seeing and from your experience. I mean, what is a good intro for somebody who owns a business, might be thinking about selling, and they're thinking, well, maybe private equity be interested. Mm-hmm. What should they know about this industry in general and the different PE firms out there?
Okay, well, that's a pretty broad question. Let me see if I can tackle it from a few angles there. So I'm going to come at this from the assumption that there's some general knowledge of private equity, but maybe some inexact knowledge, and I'll just kind of ramble a little bit and we can flesh it out. But essentially, let me just start with the basics of what a private equity firm is. A private equity firm, they're in the business of buying, growing, and exiting companies for hopefully more than they bought it for. And the way they do that is they typically raise a fund through their limited partners. And limited partners are typically institutional money, pensions, endowments, high net worth individuals, family offices, and such. They raise a fund that has a 7 to 10 year lifetime, and the private equity firm then puts that money to work by buying companies. And their hope is to grow those companies, produce cash flow, and exit at a good return on investment, you know, for their limited partners and also for themselves. So that's kind of the mechanism, you know, how they work. We can talk about how they create value later if you want to, but, you know, is a private equity firm the right buyer for your company? Well, you know, that depends on a lot of factors, primarily size, but also industry. So by way of size, you know, there's a huge range of private equity firms out there, and they go from billions of dollars of interest in enterprise value, you know, company size, down to, you know, single digit millions. And so there's a long tail of the firms out there, but at some point, you know, the transactions get small enough that it's not really just logistically practical to make investments of small sizes for a platform investment. But I will also say that for add-on investments, you know, private equity firms often have this model whereby they buy a platform investment and then they have add-on investments to it. Most private equity firms have size criteria for platforms, but for add-ons, it can be more strategic interest rather than size. And so usually there's not a lower limit on the add-on acquisitions. So size is one limitation, geography being another, and industry. If you have an industry, there is a private equity firm interested in it. There's a lot of private equity firms out there. The trick is finding which ones are interested in your company, and that's where we come in.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about these different sizes, because as a broker, I get these emails all the time, right, from private equity firms that are out there. They're reaching out to just these large databases of brokers, and they typically are saying, hey, we're looking for investment opportunities in manufacturing with this, that, the other thing. A lot of times it just does not fit what we do at all. Obviously, there's no reason. But they always list a minimum EBITDA that they want to see. And typically what we're seeing from the ones that reach out to us would be EBITDAs of minimum of 10 million, 5 million, 2.5, and in some rare cases, 1 million, but almost never below that. And so,
yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So, what do you see with that? I mean, first of all, I think we can ask the question why. A lot of the listeners are probably thinking, well, it's obvious why. But for those that may not be catching on to that, why do they have these size requirements in there? And then, second of all, if you could comment on that breakdown. I mean, are private equities looking for these quote unquote smaller in the world of bootstrapped entrepreneurs, $1 million EBITDA is a decent deal, but for a private equity firm, that's you know, tiny little bits of money there. How does that break down?
Yeah, let me answer those in reverse. So the spread, you kind of said it right. You know, most of them are 10, 25 million in EBITDAs. That's where the bigger firms, the upper middle market firms are going to be, and middle market firms. You start getting down to the 5 million, down to 1 million in EBITDA, the herd thins, but there are firms that will do it. And I think really the trick there is if you're operating in that size range, the trick is not to be considered a platform investment, right? You want to be considered an add-on investment. And the single best way to find the right private equity firm for your company, if you're selling it, if you're down in that range, even $500,000, $1 million in EBITDA, it's getting pretty low, but it is to use a database like ours to keyword search based on keywords that describe your company, the portfolio companies that are owned by private equity firms. And we allow you to do this. You can search almost 80,000, I guess a little over 80,000 of them now, and find those portfolio companies that are currently owned by private equity firms. And that is, you know, they look like your company. So that's the single best gauge to determine a private equity firm's fit or interest in your firm and your company is that they've already made a platform investment and you might be a likely add-on. So that's the process I would go about to discover those sort of rifle shot hits that you're looking for. And you can use a tool like ours to find that. Why the size limitations? Well, they have a fund and they have to deploy that money. And if you have a $100 million fund and you're deploying it at single digit millions at a time, it's too much work. You'll never get it deployed. And that's really just driving the limitations there.
Right, right. I think we've addressed this. We had the podcast topic a while ago on should you buy big or should you buy small? You know, I've addressed this topic a number of times as well, where if you have the resources available to be able to run a larger enterprise from just making your dollars work, the larger acquisitions make so much more sense, right? The workload, the resources that go into a lot of internet companies doesn't really scale at the same rate as the revenues do. And so it makes sense to do that. So for a private equity firm to come in and try and buy up a company doing 250,000 in EBITDA just doesn't make much sense. They're not going to reach the goals that they're looking for. And also the capitalization rates. I mean, how large are these private equity firms? How much capital are they trying to deploy through acquisitions?
It really depends on the firm. You know, if you wanted to, I don't know off the top of my head, but I've done studies on this based on our data. And I've done some data studies and we've published it to our blog. So if people want to visit our blog, you can read more about it. But it's very typical to have fund sizes in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right, right. So let me take a little bit of a diversion real quick. I want to ask you a question a trend that I've seen in our space here in the online acquisition space. I call them micro funds because I don't really have another word for them, but these people that are raising $10 to $15 to $20 million, and they're doing it following that private equity sort of model of bringing in those investors. Their goal is to bring in a few companies, have some synergies between those companies, grow them, and hopefully sell them off. Are you guys tracking those at all at this point?
So at that level, what we typically see is a firm that has raised capital because they have an operating partner with very specific industry experience, and they're looking to buy a company or two. In that case, they're likely not in our database. And it's not because we don't know about them. It's just for fit reasons. Most of our customers that we serve are middle market investment bankers. And because of that, we want to provide them a data set of firms that are likely going to close a deal. And if you're buying one or two companies, the probability of you closing that deal is pretty small, especially if you've already closed one, right?
Right.
So, you know, the firms that are in our database are only those firms that have committed capital, that are closing deals in the marketplace, or sometimes they're fundless sponsors, but they have to demonstrate that they're actually closing deals. Because at the end of the day, investment bankers and firms like yours, you want to close a deal. So you want to make sure that the people that you're approaching from our database have some probability of making that happen.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. All right, let's talk a little bit about, and again, you've said this a couple of times, so I'm going to reiterate it. We're talking generalities when I'm asking you some of these questions. Yeah. Every firm operates differently. Some like this sort of incubator method. It's going to be different from one firm to the next. But I want to talk about typical deal structures. And let's say that we have somebody who they've built up a company, and let's say that they're in that seven-figure EBITDA range or low-figure EBITDA range as well. I know I'm working with people in that low eight-figure EBITDA range. They're looking for an exit, you know, down the road. And they're definitely in that private equity territory where that's what makes most sense. So when you're approaching private equity firms with a business, let's just focus mainly on that seven-figure EBITDA range, you know, the 1 to 5 million, say that we have some people there, some PE firms there. What sort of deal structures do you typically see? Are they completely asset-based acquisitions? Are they stock? Are they management buyouts with the manager staying on? And if there's no general rule, that's fine too, of course.
There's no general rule, but there are some factors, as you know, that sway the rules. let me organize my thoughts on how to answer that. So asset deals versus equity deals, there's no all-encompassing rule for that. you know, generally speaking, I mean, and let me just sort of educate the audience a little bit. There's a good analogy for this. If you think about your company as a bag with a bunch of marbles in it, and the marbles are the assets, buyers like to come in and pick out the marbles they want. That's an asset deal. I want this marble, and this marble, and those are, that's what I want. That's an asset deal. You keep the corporate entity and all the other marbles I don't want. Whereas a stock deal, equity deal says, I'll just buy the bag and all the marbles in it, right? Good, bad, and ugly. Well, as a general rule, buyers prefer asset deals and sellers prefer stock deals because it's just gets rid of it. Buyers don't want the ugly marbles, the litigation, the potential liabilities, you know this stuff. So just for your audience though, typically we find that the buyer wins because they're the ones with the money. So if you want a deal done, you're going to do an asset deal. So there's not a hard and fast rule. The exception to that is oftentimes when there's customer contracts in place that you don't want to have to renegotiate. You don't want to create a new corporate entity. Then oftentimes those become stock deals just for logistical purposes. What's the other part of your question? You're looking at a seven-figure EBITDA deal.
So the basic structure of it. We've run into some cases where we've worked with private equity firms, but they wanted to have a management team in place before
Right.
Or the structure of the deal. Is it cash? Is it cash financing? Is it cash?
Right. Again, it's going to be all over the place. But generally speaking, if the owner is retiring, if owner founder is retiring, the seller. That's one case, whereas if they're wanting to stay on and run it and grow it, that's another case. If they're retiring, then it's going to be mostly a cash out kind of deal. But if there's a continuity there and they're selling the vast majority of their equity to a private equity firm, retaining a small minority stake, on the order of 10-20%, that's a different sort of deal. And that's probably the preference for most private equity firms. Again, we're talking generalities. All firms operate differently. If you have a strong management team that wants to stay on, the private equity firm is going to be interested in that. If they're interested in your company because of its industry, its size, its growth trajectory, and its promise going forward, they want that management to stay on and they want them properly incentivized and aligned. So typically what we'll see, it's not unusual at all to see a certain sort of enterprise value established at the exit of the majority of your stake, and then the private equity firm infusing that company with capital and all sorts of tools to create value, and then having a subsequent equity exit, whereby the original owner's second exit is as much as or more the first exit. It happens quite frequently. It doesn't mean it will happen, obviously, right. but it's not so unusual.
Yeah, and I think that falls in this territory of thinking outside the box of some of the regular deals that most people think of. I talk to a lot of sellers who they want that 100% exit. They've got another project they're going to move on.
Right.
But sometimes the really good deals, if you do find that good firm, involves getting that partial exit or that first exit and then that second exit later on, can be, like you said, just as lucrative, if not more lucrative, because you've got this team behind you. Let's talk a little bit about 2018 and some of the trends.
I'm going to add on to that a little bit before we move on. Is that okay?
Please. Yeah.
One of the things that people, I guess, wonder is, why is it a private equity firm can come in, buy a majority position of the equity and create value where I couldn't? And a lot of that stems from they don't have their entire net worth tied up in that company or a huge swath of it, whereas an owner founder does. So they can come in and infuse it with capital where an owner would go, I don't know if I want to throw the rest of my nest egg at the basket, the same basket is already all in. And so a private equity firm can take greater risks because it's a small percentage of their portfolio in total. And, and as a bootstrapped operation, there's a mathematical limit to how much you can grow your company without outside capital. Right? It has to do with your profit margins. There's a straight mathematical relationship. Your profit margins are X, your growth can be Y and no more. So your opportunity for outside capital is debt or equity. And founders oftentimes don't have the appetite for debt. And this is where private equity can come in and infuse the company with capital at a risk for them that's much more acceptable than it is for the owner founder, and try some things that are maybe riskier and get that company to grow through multiple expansion and taking on new projects and whatnot. So that's kind of why they're able to do that, whereas an owner sometimes isn't willing to take that leap of faith.
I think there's another aspect to that as well. I think I'm glad you stopped me with that. We talk a lot on this podcast, conferences, just people that we talk to in general, entrepreneurs, these bootstrapped entrepreneurs, or even the guys that have come in, maybe bought something small and are growing it. I put them in that same category of this bootstrapped entrepreneur who this is their livelihood. And if it's not 100% of the livelihood, it makes them a good part of it. A lot of people are not operating with an aim towards an exit. Maybe it's in the back of their mind. So they do a few things here and there, and they do this. But a private equity firm has this holding period. They have this goal of, we're growing this, we're going to get the cash flow from this. And in most cases, or in a lot of cases, they're looking for that exit with that company as well, where they can profit from.
That's right. And it drives a huge sense of urgency day after day after day. And right. Once you're owned by a private equity firm, it's hit the ground running. It really is, because they're driving that growth, because they need to grow the company and exit it before their fund timeframe runs out. And so it's a bit of a race. But with that comes a lot of operational efficiencies. They'll add to your institutionalizing the company in terms of processes and measurement and systems control and governance and just all the stuff that, you know, you should do as a company, but, you know, sometimes that stuff falls between the cracks.
I'm going to make a plug. So Walker Diable, who works with Quiet Light Brokers now, he's the executive producer of a number of documentaries, and one of them is Print the Legend on Netflix. And it's about the 3D printing industry. There's a really cool part in there where you see MakerBot go through this transition of bootstrap, you know, the classic starting in the warehouse, garage, everybody's really agile doing what they have to do. And then they take outside money and it becomes institutionalized. And one of the women, I cannot remember what her name was, but she said, she's like, I call this part trying to put the skeleton into the jellyfish. They're trying to get a backbone into a jellyfish, right? And I thought, I'm like, that's
a great analogy.
It is. It's a great movie, by the way. Print the Legend, you can get it on Netflix. And again, that's my shameless plug for Walker.
I love it.
Yeah, so let's talk about 2018. Let's talk about some of the trends that you're seeing in 2018. Actually, no, let's back up. We're going to talk about that in a minute, because we just said that they buy these companies with a goal to exit. What is a typical time frame? What is the holding period that most companies are looking? Most of the private equity firms are looking to hold companies before doing that exit.
We do a report about every 6 months to update the holding period, and we say, well, of all the companies that have exited, you know, in 2018, how long were they held? And we compare it to 6 months ago in 2017, 2016, going back in time. And I sent you a graph of this beforehand, and we can post that if you want to or whatever, or make it, or you can visit our blog and see that study. But generally speaking, I think most people would say, look, the general private equity holding period is, you know, 3 to 7 years. That's the right answer. It's fairly generic, and that's kind of all encompassing. But I wrote down some stats here. The median holding period right now, as of a couple months ago, is 4.8 years. So of all the companies that have exited in 2018, they were held just shy of 5 years. By way of comparison, we saw a max holding period of 5.6 years in 2014. Well, why was it so long then? Well, if you take 2014 and you subtract out 5.6 years, you're looking at companies, you're shaking your head, you know what I'm going to say. You're looking at companies that were bought at the peak of the valuations right before the recession. So those are companies that are portfolio companies owned by private equity firms that got bought in the beginning of 2008, unfortunate timing, and then just hit the recession, and they just had to hold a lot longer to either break even or realize any value. So that increased the holding period. And we saw a minimum, conversely, in the year 2000, when we had the dot-com boom, of 3.0 years. And we saw another minimum in 2008, you know, at the peak of that bubble there at 3.5 years. So that leads me to think that if you start getting around, I'm going to say, holding periods of 4 years or less, maybe it's an indicator of a little bit of exuberance in the market. And so right now we're at 4.8 years and it is declining. It is consistently going down every time we check. So we're aiming to the four. We're not there yet.
That's fascinating data. We've actually had that conversation internally quite a bit as far as the trends of the market and what we're thinking. And what we're seeing right now, we're seeing one of the more aggressive markets in the 11-year history of Quiet Light. Now, granted, Quiet Light Brokerage, when I first started it, was 2007, and we were really just getting our feet wet and getting going. So we didn't have a lot of data, real good, useful data. Then we hit the recession. So you take the first 6-7 years, it's, you know, pretty bearish data that we're working with.
Right.
You know, so comparatively, like, this is the time that we're in right now feels really, really strong. And that's interesting. Oh,
it's, I mean, and we can talk about statistics, because one of the great things about having a database is it lends itself to just doing data studies and slicing and dicing the data. And it really pops out interesting trends. Right now, valuations are high. No secret. I think you and everyone in your industry knows valuations are high. And I'll actually plug you guys a little bit here, or your world of investment banking and business brokerage. If you are a company owner and you are thinking about selling in the next 3 to 4 years, if it's even on your horizon, there may not be another time that is this good for valuations. It is as good as it gets. I mean, there are a couple of economic factors that are sort of meta macroeconomic factors that are happening that are making this a sort of sustained seller market, but that'll change. Those factors, just real quickly, money's cheap right now. Monetary policy has made interest rates low. It's cheap to borrow money. It's fueling a lot of growth. Companies are growing. But consequently, those people with money are looking for, where can I get a better return on my capital instead of, you know, CDs and treasuries and stuff like that. So they're looking at the alternative asset space. They're putting money into private equity, which has created more private equity firms than ever before, with larger funds than ever before, looking for the same deals as everybody else. So there's a huge, from a financial buyer perspective, there's a huge demand. And then the other factor that plays with that is a social factor. And that is, you probably thought this, as did I, when the baby boomers were going to retire in their mid-60s, we thought there would be this huge influx of businesses for sale as they start to retire. And that largely didn't happen. They just kept working. The baby boomers just kept working. And that'll eventually come out of the pipeline. But right now, because they've held their businesses longer, they've built a pent-up demand, and so because they're limiting the supply. So on the one hand, you have money trying to chase deals. On the other hand, you have fewer deals. That's what's creating this sustained seller's market where valuations are high. It will change. It will go back down. It will revert to the mean. You cannot, this is my opinion, not data, but you cannot make money on the assumption that someone else is willing to overpay in future years like you did today.
Yeah. Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. And last year around this time, I wrote one of the last blog posts that I personally wrote, and we started the podcast instead before we, mm-hmm. we started recording here. I was telling you that I like doing this, it's a lot less work.
Yeah, right.
But I talked about the history of what we've seen over the years. And during those recessionary years, boy, if you got a 2.7 or 2.8 on discretionary earnings for a business, it was a really solid deal. And today people are looking at that saying, why would I ever sell for that? Understanding multiples, they're relative to the time, they're relative to the supply and demand within the marketplace and what money is out there and what other investment vehicles are out there as well. Is when you're thinking about when to exit, when you're thinking about buying and growing and turning this around in the case of a private equity firm, that's crucial data to really kind of hone in on and understand. What are you seeing trending this year? I know I was contacted by BuzzFeed a while ago about private equity firms starting to get into the Amazon space and really looking more towards e-commerce, specifically within the Amazon marketplace. What are you seeing as far as different trends in the private equity space? Is there any industries that seem to be popping up right now?
There are. You know, we study the portfolio companies and what's changing over time. I sort of have a top 10 list for 2018 that I'll run down with you. Top of the list has always been, and maybe always will be, manufacturing.
I see that all the time. Yep.
Everyone, you know, likes a solid, just basic manufacturing company, no frills, you know, just consistent cash flow, consistent growth, predictable money. That said, manufacturing as a percentage of the portfolio companies is way less than it used to be. So coming hot on its heels are the, like, sort of number 2, 3, and 4 positions, which number 2 is software. So far this year, software deals are a big deal. And number 3 is technology. Those kind of go together. And it makes sense. You know, anything that you can scale like you can with software and technology, private equity firms are interested in the ability to find a concept that scales with very low CapEx, which software and technology tend to do. And also you have this component of recurring revenue, also a big theme for the private equity firms. The others I'll run down. Number 4 was healthcare. Interestingly enough, number 5 was data businesses, information services, much like mine. 6 would be oil and gas, which is interesting because there for a while that went away. You know, oil went down so cheap and there's nobody, you know, everybody was losing money in all the oil and gas services companies and the PE firms just weren't doing that, but it's coming back. 7 is medical. 8, construction, which is a bit interesting. Traditionally, we would not see much construction-related private equity investments, mostly because it tends to be fairly CapEx heavy. Number 9 was transportation and logistics, and number 10 was engineering, so another kind of services company.
Fascinating. The software, I would assume SaaS businesses would kind of fall in that
area. Well, that's the preferred, that's the preferred model. Not always, but that's where everybody's going. Everyone's going to SaaS and everyone's going to the cloud.
Right, Right.
What about the action is.
What about consumer products? I mean, that's obviously not in your top 10 list.
You know, off the top of my head, I don't know what it is. There are a number of private equity firms that specifically build consumer product brands and focus on that exclusively. Some well-known firms that have done really well. I know there for a while, food and sort of ingredients businesses were pretty hot. I don't know if that trend is still as hot as it used to be, but yeah, consumer brands is definitely a hot industry. It's just not on our top 10.
Sure.
I hear it all the time.
Sure. What are some of the things that private equity firms just love to see when they're looking for an acquisition target?
Yeah, some of the things we already touched on, recurring revenue. I mean, it's all about stability of cash flow. So I would say stability of cash flow, sort of quality of earnings kind of companies, scalable businesses that have strong cash flow and a track record of growth. And those firms that are maybe a little more venture capital minded might say, you know, what's the opportunity here in terms of like, can this just blow up as a trend, or is this software tool just meeting this huge demand in the cloud space that's going to be the next revolution of software? So that sort of thing. But really, it's all about cash flow stability, growth, scalability.
All right. And then what are some of the things, I mean, people can probably draw some conclusions, but what are some of the things that they want to avoid?
Yeah. So in addition to just like the opposite of those things,
right.
Private equity firms, it'll be difficult to find firms that will do project-based financing as opposed to just an outright purchase acquisition. They don't want to finance your projects. They typically will not do projects that require a lot of CapEx. That said, I did say construction was in the top 10, so I'm not sure about that. But traditionally, it's just hard to scale companies when you have to put a lot of money in upfront for property, plant, and equipment. And then lastly, at least for the firms that we track, we do not track those that, not in this particular data set, those that invest in real estate. The traditional buyout M&A private equity firms, you just need a longer time horizon than 7 or 10 years to make sure that the real estate pays off like it should. So, but we do track in another data module, institutional real estate investors, and that's a different animal altogether and probably outside the scope of this conversation, but they typically are just not going to buy real estate.
Got a question for you on general multiples, and let's talk software and tech. And if you don't have this data right now, I know I'm springing this on you. I didn't prep you
that's
on
right.
this one.
That's right.
We talk often that there's a bit of a multiple shift when you get to certain levels in EBITDA, right?
Some
companies don't typically get the strongest multiples as you move up. You know, we see these multiple shifts. What are some of the demarcation lines that you see for EBITDAs where these multiples do start to inch up? Or is it just kind of a gradual scale where you're seeing that happen?
You know, I don't know if there's definite lines, and I don't know if I'm going to know the answer to that question, but just let me talk kind of a lot of hand-waving principles around that.
Sure. That's
I think it is. It just kind of scales linearly with size. Companies that are bigger tend to be more stable. And when you're more stable, that's perceived to be less risk for a buyer and therefore more valuable and hence a higher multiple, right? And so that is why one of the methodologies that private equity firms use is this buy and build, you know, platform and add-on strategy is you buy the platform company, you take a smaller add-on investment, you buy it for, I'm just going to make up a number, 6x EBITDA, and suddenly you put it in, you fold it into a bigger company, and that same sort of producing asset is now worth 8x because it's part of a bigger company. So you got a 2x sort of free value out of that bolt-on. And I can remember meeting with, I won't name the name, but a private equity firm we were meeting with one time. We were working on a deal back when I used to do deals. And he was outlining that strategy for me. He's like, yes, it's really just not rocket science. That's just what we do. it's pretty simple. You buy it for 5 and you get 7 automatically. Free money.
Right. I had these conversations with buyers over the years that their first footsteps into the space of buying, in our case, online businesses, start with them maybe on Flip, on buying these, you know, kind of rinky dink, $20,000-$30,000 sites. And that's their appetite. The next thing you know, they're doing an SBA loan and they're buying something bigger.
Right.
Invariably, once they have enough success, that light bulb goes off in their head where they look at that and say, wait a minute, I can bolt on to my company over here, which is more valuable, a company that is less valuable here. And if I can fold them in, I'm getting this multiple jump and I'm adding value immediately. And in addition, especially with the sizes that we're looking at, I can buy something with EBITDAs of 500,000. But if I buy 4 of these, combine them, now I'm not buying at a multiple of 2.8 or 3. I'm buying into multiple, I'm now able to sell it maybe at 3.3, 3.5, or whatever the case may be for that industry.
Right.
It's this double whammy of evaluations that go up. And it's that light bulb moment that goes off where then the next thing I know, they're building a fund on their own to be able to do that.
Now, it's easy for us to say, and it's much harder to implement, right? You can say, oh, that's just free money. But, you know, there's a lot of hoops you got to jump through to make that happen, and integrations and all that. And it's hard work. And that's why not everyone's doing it. But it is kind of conceptually not that difficult to understand.
Right. Okay. Where can people find you if they want more information and if they want to start kind of exploring this world of private equity outside of the blog? That'd be a great place to start. But where can they find you for more information?
So you can go to our website, privateequityinfo.com. At the bottom, there's contact us. You'll see my phone number and my email. I'm happy to take calls. I'm happy to answer emails. If you have questions about private equity, you have questions about your business and is it right for private equity, just pick my brain. That's fine. We're happy to do that. We love to talk to customers and potential customers and help people out.
Very good. Hey, thanks so much for coming on. I can see having you on once 2019 rolls around and we get into some of the trends there. Start paying attention to these holding periods that are happening. I think that's a really cool stat to be able to be tracking here. And also just kind of see where the trends are with these top industries that are kind of popping up as time goes by here.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been fun. Let's do it again.
Hey, thanks. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.